Welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Suzanne Hogan. Steve Kraske is away. But first today, alcoholic spirits have a long, deep relationship with the human race. From ancient meads, native cultures using corn, agave, honey, cactus, fruit seed pods, rice grapes, or whatever grains available to make spirits or alcoholic beverages to enjoy. Our guest today has written a lot about the relationship between humans' cultivation of these plants to produce the alcohol we enjoy. Amy Stewart, welcome to Up to Date.
Hey, thanks. It's good to be here.
Amy has appeared on our program in the past talking about her books Wicked Plant and Flower Confidential. Her newest book is The Drunken Botanist, The Plants That Create the World's Great Drinks. Amy, how much drinking did you do while researching this book?
You know what? I have to say, I have the most amazing liquor collection you have ever seen, because everything was research, right? I was able to justify, like, oh, I need rose petal liqueur. I have to know what it's like before I write about it. So, yeah, the parties at my house have been pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, it sounds pretty fun. So you were on Morning Edition yesterday, and you did this thing where you identified all the botany in a Manhattan, which kind of brought into light all the different plants that are involved in a really common cocktail that we enjoy. I was wondering if today on this program you could start by doing the same thing for an old-fashioned.
Oh, an old-fashioned. Yeah, it's actually my favorite drink, really. So we start with bourbon. I think a few people make old-fashioneds with rye whiskey or something else, but I'm a bourbon drinker. So we start with a bourbon. And bourbon, by law, has to be at least 51% corn, although most brewers use a little more corn than that in it. It also contains barley. Barley is found in almost all grain spirits because barley actually contains a lot of the enzymes that help break starch back into sugar, and that's what you need for grains. You have to take that stored up starch and turn it back into sugar in order to ferment it. So there's always a little barley. And then most bourbons have some rye in it as well. And rye has a spicy, almost bitter note that's really wonderful, but some bourbon makers do it with wheat instead. So there's three grains right there. And I think that we cannot forget the oak barrel that the bourbon ages in, because it's so critical to the flavor of bourbon. By law, it has to go into a new American oak barrel. So the flavor of American oak is also present. So there's four plants right there. What else do you need? You need a sugar cube, and so that's sugar cane, or sometimes beet sugar. White sugar beets are often used to make sugar. You need some Angostura bitters, and we don't know quite how many plants are found in Angostura bitters because it's the company's secret recipe, but here's what we have. We know we have an alcohol base again, and it might be a sugarcane base, but they might also use grains, and it says on the label that it includes gentian, which is the root of a plant that grows in the Swiss Alps. So that's in there for sure, and there are probably about a dozen other plants that go into flavoring Angostura bitters. If I were to speculate, I would guess some citrus peel, and I would guess some spices like, you know, maybe allspice or cardamom or some of the, you know, cinnamon, some of those warm tropical spices.
Yeah, bitters are kind of one of these amazing things that it's in a lot of drinks, and it's really that secret touch, but really it's kind of not clearly known what all is in it. And you say in the book that researching some of this stuff was hard because people don't want to reveal some of their secret recipes of what is actually in their drinks.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, I think that's changing a little bit. I mean, there are definitely liquor companies out there who feel that part of the mystique is that you don't know what's in it, and it's the secret recipe that's been handed down for generations. You know, a lot of liquor companies have these sort of myths about how their thing got started, and it usually involves a royal family and an imprisoned chemist, and, you know, there's always some dramatic story behind it. But I think that modern craft distillers are going in the opposite direction, and they're wanting to really celebrate their ingredients and talk about what they are. So it's nice to see that change.
Let's back up a little bit to humans' long ongoing relationship to the plants that they cultivate to make booze, pretty much. Can you give some examples of ancient fermentation?
Well, sure. You know, there's a guy named Patrick McGovern who is an archaeologist who specializes in the archaeology of fermentation and distillation. And he actually tests the residue on pottery shards found at archaeological sites to find out what people were drinking. And some of these were really interesting mixtures of stuff. So you might see grapes and barley and spices like saffron all in one beverage. So it looks like some of the earliest alcoholic beverages really weren't beer or wine, but they were maybe some hybrid or some combination of just whatever was available and fermentable.
Was there any plant that you came across in your research that you were really shocked was used in to create alcohol?
Well, yeah, here was one surprise, and this one actually got added to the book late because it had never occurred to me, and that is aloe, like aloe vera.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know this, but it turns out if you've ever had aloe juice to drink, it probably didn't strike you as very bitter. But it turns out that aloe has a shockingly bitter component to it. It's called aloin, and it's removed from aloe juice that people ingest. But I tasted some, and it is just the most unnuanced, just straight bitter flavor that I have ever experienced. And so it turns up in some of these Italian digestifs like Fernet Branca, things like that, use aloe for that really just solid backbone that you need in a liqueur like that.
You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. I'm Suzanne Hogan. We're talking with writer Amy Stewart about her latest book, The Drunken Botanist. Bartenders, bar goers, home mixologists, gardeners, if you have questions for Amy Stewart, give us a call. Our number is 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also email us at uptodate@kcur.org or tweet us at @KCURUpToDate. Let's talk about yeast. Yeast is everywhere. It's all over the place. And there's different strands that brewers have held on to. But you say that yeast is the oldest living domesticated organism, not a chicken or horse. How has yeast come to be domesticated?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, it probably happened by accident at first. So you have to sort of imagine somebody maybe having a facility, even if that facility was just like a straw hut or something, where they are regularly fermenting or distilling. Fermenting at first, of course. We weren't really distilling until about 800 AD or so. But our early history with fermentation, there would have been wild yeast that grow on the fruit itself, that live off the exudates in the bark of oak trees, that travel around on the backs of insects. So there's all this wild yeast that's just in the air and on living organisms. And if you're in a place where you are regularly fermenting, you know, grains or fruit, then over time that yeast is going to sort of get to be more and more adapted to your environment and will become its own strain that is unique to your location. So probably by accident, without really knowing what we were doing for a long, long time, we were perpetuating certain strains of yeast and using them over and over again to make alcohol.
We're going to take a call from Charlie in Fontana, Kansas. He called 816-235-2888. Charlie, welcome to Up to Date.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, I wondered if any poisonous plants had been used in the fermentation of alcohol and whether or not the fermentation process broke down the poisonous parts, the alkaloids or whatever. And I'll take my answer up here.
Okay, well, that is a very good question. And as someone who has written a book about poisonous plants, I can definitely answer this one. There are some plants that are actually used to make alcohol that have some toxic component to them. So an example of that would be a cassava root, which contains some cyanide. And people around the world eat cassava, but they have to process it pretty carefully to get the cyanide out. And it's also fermented to make beer. But the processing of it, the leaching out of the cyanide, actually makes that safe. On the other hand, there are plants that we add to the finished spirit during the distillation, you know, process, like at the distillery, in order to flavor it. And, you know, over the centuries, there have been poisonous plants that have been added to alcohol. You know, maybe it was thought to be a little medicinal, and it turned out to be a little poisonous instead. Henbane is an example of that. Of course, there was a time when opium poppies were added to alcohol to make laudanum, which was kind of a kind of a medicine and sort of turned into a recreational drink at one time.
Yeah, there seems to be a fine line between the medicinal and the recreation with alcohol throughout history.
Yeah, there is a fine line, and it is not safe to assume that any process like distillation removes the poisons. If anything, if you just drop a handful of plant matter into a jar and soak it in alcohol, you can do a pretty effective job of extracting whatever the active ingredients are, even if they're poisonous.
Right, which a lot of people are doing with tinctures, but you have to be careful with that. Isn't that right? It's kind of a growing thing, this tincture popularity.
That's right. It's a growing thing to do that, to make your own bitters, to make your own infused vodkas. And I just advise people to make sure they know what plants they're using and don't just assume that, you know, nature is all good and just there to provide us with wonderful flavors. I mean, most plants really do not want to get eaten, and they create these toxic chemicals to defend themselves and to stop you from ripping them out of the ground.
Tinctures are alcohol extract of plant or man or animal materials, just to clarify that there. Calvin and Lawrence, welcome to Up to Date.
Hi, I have a question about which liquors are actually gluten-free. I'm confident rum is and Hennessy and a few other things, but I've heard different things about the distillation process of whiskey, and that might make it gluten-free.
Yeah, it's good that you brought that up. So, right, whiskey is distilled from grain, which contains gluten, so that survives the process of being made into beer. So if you're gluten intolerant, you have to avoid beers made from those grains and only drink beers like sorghum-based beers that are free of gluten. The distillation process is generally believed to exclude all the gluten. In other words, it just does not lift out of the mash pit into the still. Right now, on the federal level, we are working on regulations to help with the labeling of that to make that really clear. So this is sort of an unsettled area, and it's one where not a lot of good research has been done. So it's widely believed that gluten does not end up in the bottle during distillation, but people who are very nervous about this will still find plenty that they can drink. I mean, there are really good vodkas made from grapes and apples and other fruit, and of course you've got sugarcane and grains like sorghum that are free of gluten. So there are other options, but you will start to see labeling on this within a year or so. Those regulations are in process right now.
Calvin, thanks for the call. Amy, you say that sorghum may be the most present plant in alcoholic beverages around the world. Can you explain why that is?
Yeah. So this was kind of one of my little research projects for this book if you were to ask somebody, like, what plants are, you know, consumed as alcohol more than any other plant in the world, people would probably think of grapes for wine or grains like, you know, barley and rye for whiskey and beer. But sorghum is grown throughout Africa and used to make a homemade beer, this cloudy, opaque beer that people just make themselves, and it's actively fermenting. It doesn't even stay stable on the shelf because it's still fermenting. When they sell it in cartons, they have to leave a little vent open because it would explode otherwise because, you know, the fermentation process builds up all this carbon dioxide. So you have to think of the vast quantities of homemade beer that can be consumed, you know, in a region as large as Africa, and then also China. So sorghum is used throughout China to make a spirit called Maotai, which is very, very commonly consumed in China. And then we have just the fact that sorghum is more generally used for sorghum beers around the world and also sorghum whiskeys. So I looked at the numbers. These numbers are sort of hard to compile, and it's hard to get good data out of China, and it's hard to get good data from Africa. But it looks like sorghum may well be the most imbibed plant in the world.
I want to get back into making things ourselves and thinking about our gardens. It's getting to be that time. What advice would you give to people who are starting to plan their gardens and who want to maybe grow some things that they can include in their cocktails this spring and summer?
Well, you know, so my first piece of advice, of course, is to grow things that you like to drink and that work for your climate. There are some very cocktail-specific plants you can grow that maybe, even if you have a good kitchen garden, you might not know about. I really like Mojito Mint, which is a strain of spearmint that is grown in Cuba, So if you go and order a mojito in Havana, that is the particular strain of mint it will have, and it has only sort of just made it into the nursery market in North America and Canada. So that's one you can get. And it's got a nice flavor, a little different from regular spearmint. And I also like, there's actually a variety of celery that I've really gotten into growing. It's called Red Venture. And the stalks are red, which is where it gets its name. And they're skinny. They're like the size of a pencil. So they make a good swizzle stick, and they look really interesting because they're dark red. And it has a great flavor for muddling into, like, savory vodka drinks, Bloody Mary, things like that.
What flowers and herbs would you suggest people start with?
Well, for flowers, there are a couple of edible flowers that make great garnishes. I was actually at a party last night, and we were serving a kind of a lavender version of a gin and tonic, and we had lavender blossoms as the garnish in every one of those drinks. And also, Johnny Jump Ups, you know, violas are edible and make a very pretty garnish in a drink. And for herbs, you know, in addition to mint, obviously you're going to want to grow some basil. And there's a variety of basil I like for cocktails that's called Greek basil. Sometimes it's sold as a globe basil, and it's a woodier cultivar. So it's a little bit longer lasting. It can start earlier in the spring. It can go longer towards the fall. And some people will even bring it inside and overwinter it like a rosemary or a more hardy basil. So that's nice because, you know, otherwise you're running out all the time and having to replant it.
And you advise people to be careful about going out and buying a bunch of fruit trees. You say a tree is kind of like a puppy. I was wondering if you could talk about that.
Right. You know, trees are long-term commitments. If you're just desperate to have a fruit tree in your backyard, one thing to keep in mind is that the rootstock that it's been grafted on determines its ultimate size. So I like small fruit trees where I can reach all the fruit on the tree without having to get up on a ladder. And so that means ordering an apple tree that's got a very dwarf rootstock it's growing on, and that will keep it small. So definitely think about that. And just understand that it may be a few years before you get any fruit, and also that some fruit trees require that you have two of them nearby in order to get fruit. So pay attention to that, and be sure and ask about it at the nursery before you take one home.
Some good, solid advice. We have time for one final caller, Leslie in Overland Park. Quickly, you're on Up to Date.
Yes. Yeah, I just was curious if you have any advice on growing hops in this area.
I have plenty of advice on growing hops. You know, it's hard for me to know exactly what everybody's weather is particularly like. In the Pacific Northwest where I live, we have a pretty easy time of it. Hops are susceptible to powdery mildew-type diseases. So if you're going to grow them, I would ask about resistant cultivars that do well in your particular region and won't succumb, because you don't want to have to spray them with fungicides. That would be no fun.
Thank you so much, Amy Stewart. I'm sorry we are out of time. Amy Stewart is the author of The Drunken Botanist, The Plants That Create the World's Great Drinks. You can find more information on all of our broadcasts at kcur.org. Thank you, Amy Stewart, for joining us this morning.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Tomorrow on the program, a KU professor wants everyone to have hope for the future. We'll talk about his psychological reform strategies. This show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, and Beth Lipoff. I'm Suzanne Hogan, and you are Up to Date.